This is Israel Connection on JA Community Radio, broadcasting live on 88 FM and streaming over the internet at j-air.com.au. My name is David Schulberg, bringing you another episode of this weekly radio program that provides analysis and insight with important interviews and discussion about Israel. Eitan Drori, OAM, is with me in the studio. Eitan manages his own consultancy company focusing on promoting Israeli innovations in Asia Pacific and Europe. He is chairman of Global Israeli Leadership that fosters worldwide Israeli diasporic leadership. Welcome, Eitan, to the program.
Thank you very much, David, for welcoming me and for your introduction.
On Zoom, we will be speaking now with Achal Bezorai, an Israeli certified forum facilitator and coach and British lawyer who currently lives in the Philippines. Achal, born in Kibbutz Be'eri, is a former officer in an IDF Navy commando unit and the chairman of the Young President Organization London chapter. Achal's younger sister was killed in Kibbutz Be'eri on October the 7th, while her husband was taken hostage. Welcome, Achal, to the Israel Connection. I believe you deserve a big mazel tov with your wife having just had a baby.
Hi, David. Pleasure to be here. Thanks so much for welcoming me so warmly.
I'm very happy to indeed. Achal, may I ask you about your family background, how you came to be born 60 years ago in Kibbutz Be'eri?
I think it all starts, with the birds and the bees. I don't want to go into too much detail there. So I was born in Kibbutz Be'eri many, many years ago. I was brought up there. All my upbringing, education was there. And still my dad and two sisters lived there until October 7th. And as you mentioned, one of them actually was murdered as part of this massacre that took over on October 7th by Hamas.
Tell us more about your family and how your parents and what their background is. I understand your father was from Yemen and your mother is of Polish background, and how they were the founders of, or your father was the founder of the Kibbutz Be'eri.
Yeah. So actually they were the second... they weren't actually the founders, but they were the second wave of people who set up the kibbutz. My father was born in Rehovot. He was from a very religious Yemenite family. His dad was a big rabbi, but his mom, my grandmother, always, in a way, pushed them out of the religious and more into youth movement. So he was a member of the youth movement that ultimately then ended up joining Kibbutz Be'eri. My mom, she's originally from parents from Russia and Poland, and she was born in Kibbutz Na'an. She's an older kibbutz in Be'eri, so she all her upbringing was through kibbutz lifestyle, which is very different to any other lifestyle that you might live at. She joined this Garin, or this group of people, joined Be'eri, and she was a very beautiful woman. My dad, I think, wasn't so handsome, and I don't know, somehow they managed to get together, and that's how it happened.
So you say your father was really in a sense a pioneer of Israel, who has helped to perpetuate the Zionist dream of making helping to develop a kibbutz that was on the fringes of Israel.
Yes, in a sense, you know, I don't look at it with such big words, pioneer and the Zionist dream. You know, he did what was right for him at the time and what was right for Israel at the time. You know, without all this accolade that now people attribute to it. But yes, I'm very proud of him and of my mom, you know, that they've decided to do, in a sense, you know, set the borders of Israel south through the kibbutzim that they lived at or in. So yeah, I'm very proud of him, you know, pioneer and this. it's not for me to say, but yes, some people look at it that's in this sort of fashion.
So when we talk about Kibbutz Be'eri, we can't forget now what happened there on October the 7th. So what did you feel when you got a phone call from your sister and your father on that fateful day?
So it worked the other way around. So I heard about it because here it was already like 12:30 or 1 when we heard about it in the afternoon. And there it was 6:30 in the morning. So actually I called them and I saw that my dad was hiding in the safety room. You know, he's 90, so it's not obvious. But he has a partner, so she looked after him, a life partner. And then I spoke to my sister, and she's in the neighborhood, which is closer to the fence, if you like, that facing Gaza. And, you know, she was at very anxious times and couldn't really talk. So she said, Ali, you know, look, I cannot really talk. People are shooting, etc. And I was surprised, you know, because what I thought was just this missile attack, you know, that was something that happened nearly every week. And then suddenly, you know, she said there were terrorists shooting. And, you know, then you hear it on the news here. That it was really something of a different scale. And then I lost contact. The last time I spoke to my sister was at about 9:15. And then we assumed that she was kidnapped together with the two children and husband. So I went on many, many interviews for many CNN and Fox and BBC and Sky and, you know, just to create some sort of awareness to her being missing and hostage. And then like 10 days after October 7th, they pulled out like 120 bodies out of Be'eri. And it transpired that my sister actually was murdered, not kidnapped. So I obviously flew back to Israel. And then we decided to hold up the funeral in case the others are also dead, you know, the children and the husband. And then like 5 days later, we got confirmation actually that they were hostages. They are not part of the body count. So we buried my sister. She was not buried on Be'eri. She was buried on another kibbutz because you're not allowed to carry. So it's a temporary grave. You're not allowed to carry a burial or congregation of people in Be'eri. So we buried her in a different kibbutz temporarily, and you know we said Shiva, and then I flew back here, and then the children were released in the second wave after I think 54 days. Two children. She had another older boy who is 18, wasn't on the kibbutz. He was in Shnat Shirut on national service, so he was out of Be'eri. So. Obviously was with us during the Shiva. And the two children, and the daughter is 13, she just did a bar mitzvah last June. And the boy, the second boy is 17. So really young children. I spoke to them as they came back during the night. They were really distraught. They didn't have easy time in captivity, to say the least.
Hmm.
And still, I think they struggle with the coming to terms with having mom murdered, dad is still hostage, and no one really knows. No one has any news about him, whether he's alive, dead, or his whereabouts. The parents of Dror, the husband of my sister, who is still in a hostage. They look after the children, but even they find it a bit difficult because they are teenagers and you know, they have all these issues around being held captive and maybe being orphans, orphans for the moment. So it's very difficult state of affair for us as a family. I feel extremely sorry for my dad. At the age of 90, he needs to say Shiva on his younger daughter. It's something that no parent should
exactly
need to experience or you know, it's shocking. And although he's a very strong person and he takes no medication of whatever nature, still impacted him, not sort of much physically, but mentally. So it's tough, just tough to see. And he tries to keep a strong facade, and you know, but when I'm with him one-on-one, sometimes he cannot hold his emotion and he cries, or we cry together. You know, just thinking about us, you know, my sister, his daughter. So it's a tough, really tough situation. And for Barry, because they're all evacuated now, all in a hotel in the Dead Sea. Very prosperous and successful kibbutz. When will they be able to come back? I'm not sure. 30% of all the houses have been destroyed. I was there just the day after the funeral of my sister, before we were starting to see Shiva. And the house is totally and utterly burned down. I was there with my boys from London in last April, like a year ago. We were sitting there watching Barcelona playing football with their children, with Donat and Dror. We had dinner together. It was the first time that my boys actually bonded with my sister kids, because suddenly they are a little bit older. They can speak a bit of English. My kids don't speak Hebrew. And they have some common themes that they can chat about, like football, music. So it was really, really nice to see this. And then it was all cut by this massacre.
Eitan, do you want to...
Yes. Hi. I would like to reverse a little bit to the beginning of David's question about your feeling and your response to the news on the 7th of October, spontaneously as a born and bred kibbutznik from Berry. I wanted to ask you about your immediate response to the situation, to what happened on the 7th, the outset, the thinking, growing up in a kibbutz on the edge of Israel, on the border with the enemies, and what you've received educationally at school along the years as a kid, growing up to a totally within the green lines settlers community and family. And we all hear the personal touching stories, the sadness and of course the hope for a better situation. But I would like to ask you really about your basic feelings immediately when you heard that the people of the region were not protected.
So I think the first thing is, you know, it's a shock, because you don't expect Israel to be so exposed to some, you know, minor terrorist organization within the Middle East. We have bigger enemies that we managed to deal with more competently, and then this Hamas terrorist organization caused so much havoc and destruction in one day with really very, very little military response. So I think first it was shock. Second, you know, I never, in a way, feared that something like this would happen. You know, you grow up, you don't, like kibbutz, you don't lock the doors. It's a very safe sort of environment. You don't think of the Gazan as some sort of an enemy. You know, the people of Gaza, you know, you hope that they want peace. And one day there will be peace. You know, I always say, you know, when I was a child on the kibbutz, like, you know, when we're lying as teenagers on the lawn and looking at the stars in the evening, you know, when there was a falling star, what I always wished for is for, please God, make peace. I never said make me rich. I never say made me successful. All I always prayed for is peace. And then you get this sort of in your face at the side, and suddenly you wake up and you realize, or you don't realize, you know, your dream has been shattered, because you hope that there will be one sort of some sort of a peace, and then suddenly you realize that you deal with people who are psychotic in the perception of life or the sanctification of death, and it's just very difficult for someone like me, you know, to come to terms that I now need to fight and try to kill rather than try to search for peace. And there is a very interesting story, you know, on the kibbutz. There was this lady named Vivian Silva. She was an immigrant from Jewish immigrant from Canada, lived in Israel in a kibbutz for many, many years. She was probably in her 70s, and she dedicated her life to help people from Gaza. She used to go to the areas crossing. She used to wait with the car. Children could come. She takes them to Barzilai Hospital in Ashkelon or to Soroka. This is what she did. She dedicated her life to help these people. And then on October 7th, she was murdered in her bed. 70-something year-old lady. So I don't think I have hatred towards them because they killed my sister, because this would not give her back. But there is some sort of realization that maybe the dreams that I had as a child and then as a soldier, and because it's when you see the atrocities and you know what war can cause you as human, how it can change you and what it can cause to people that you fight against, it's not something that you wish may continue. You want it to stop in some sort of way, and then you are forced, really forced, by the other side to become militant and aggressive, and you know, having to now destroy them. And it's sad, you know, because it's part of the destruction of Hamas. You harm many, many maybe uninvolved Gazans, or maybe just suffer as a side effect of all that. And it's sad, because you don't, as an Israeli army, you don't want to kill uninvolved civilians. But sometimes they use them as human shields, and you have no... So what breaks my heart is that we as a country are forced to go into this war to destroy Hamas. As a result, we impact so many maybe uninvolved people. I don't know, because they were always also celebrating when they brought the hostages to Gaza. So you don't know who is really involved and who is not. But Hamas, it's now proven, I think, beyond reasonable doubt, that they use humans as human shield. And when you fight for your existence and you need to keep Israel safe, and as a result of that you need to destroy Hamas, what else can you do?
I think actually more broadly, Ahal, we're seeing damage to Israel itself with the health of this startup nation that we've so often touted as being typical of what Israel is. In other words, how serious would you say is the damage to Israel's economy from what has been transpiring?
I think the spirit, the startup nation is a spirit thing. It's not just economics, because we spend this amount of time. So for me, it's more the Israeli spirit. And I don't think this or anything can break the Israeli spirit. So there, I don't have any worries that we will come stronger out of all that. I do honestly believe that. Obviously, there is a setback, because this war is extremely costly, both in terms of money and in terms of life, in terms of resources. Many people are in the miluim, in the reserve, for many, many years. And as such, they don't do the jobs or run the businesses. But I think the Israeli spirit would prevail. at the end of the day. So, and the Startup Nation is really about the Israeli spirit that can overcome even harder and did overcome even more difficult situations.
Yes, we certainly hoping so. But with this dreadful ongoing situation, Ahal, with the hostages and the fact that 200,000 Israelis from the north and the south of the country are living in hotels and are unable to return to their homes for security reasons, how do you feel about the current Israeli government and how it's going about managing this extremely difficult situation?
You know, I don't think it's my place to criticize the Israeli government. I want to believe that they try the best to bring back the hostages and to remedy the situation. I know that there is a lot of criticism. Maybe I'm partly part of it, that maybe there are some people that are not competent. Maybe they should have taken more responsibility to what happened on October 7th rather than put it under the carpet. So that you can find ways and means to criticize. But I think at the moment we need to be united and try as a country to see how best we can get out of this very, very difficult situation and then deal with the government and have elections and then see where the people of Israel want to take the country. Do they want to continue with this government or want a new start? If you ask me, I would want a new start, but you know, I'm just one vote out of, I don't know what, 9 million, so.
Yeah, well, the numbers are certainly showing that, that probably a lot of people agree with you. You're a product of Zionism. You've also served in an IDF Navy Commando unit, so you've had the IDF experience, and you're a very successful Israeli businessman as well. With regards to your business endeavors, do you want to tell us how you've developed strong connections with Israel's important neighbors, namely countries like Iraq, Tunisia, Jordan?
So I had, when I started my, so I studied law, I became a lawyer, but I never practiced law. So my background is, my studies was law. I wanted to save, to one time to save the world as a lawyer and fighting for the destitute. And then I set up this telecom company and through, I think, a lot of luck or however you want to call it, we set up the first GSM network in Iraq together with a Kurdish partner. At the time, Kurdistan was under the auspices of the UN. It was obviously part of Iraq and still part of Iraq, but because Saddam bombed them with the mustard gas, the UN separated them sort of artificially and gave them some sort of protection. And we started there, so we set up the first GSM there, and then it became the biggest GSM network in Iraq, and in a way, the biggest company on the Iraqi stock exchange, ultimately. And when you have people and business, it's the same. You know, we never had any. They knew that I'm Israeli. They knew that my background and where I came from, and they came to my house. I went to their houses when I first went there. You know, after the second Gulf War, 2003. So ultimately, it's between people, and when you do business with people, it's this sort of interaction that enable you to, as long as you are honest and do what you say you will do, and there is some benefit to the other side from the services or ideas or technologies that you can provide them.
I'd like to catch up with you on that one. I think it's a very interesting point that you bring up here. It's about the role of Israeli leaders in various fields. Not to mention Chaim Saban in the USA, not to mention others who are based in different countries, the role of the Israeli leading and deserving figures worldwide, like yourself, speaking to many, many channels from UK, chasing you regularly, is about public diplomacy. How do you think and how would you recommend Israel to take advantage of people like you, like others, who could really help the sort of basic diplomatic efforts of Israel informally behind the scene?
And before you answer, I just should tell you, Ahal, you've got about 3 minutes.
Sure. Yeah, I'm talking too much, I know. Sorry, David.
That's fine.
You just asked these open questions. So, Eitan, I really have no answer to this. I think part of the problem is that there are a lot of big egos in this space of Israeli public opinion. You just saw it. There was this guy who was very, very good, and then there was some fallout. I don't know with who, but someone in government, and then they sacked him because he was supporting the
Elon Levy
government.
Elon Levy.
Yes. You know, so there are this. So I believe it's there are so many intricacies and politics involved in it. And when I see this, I just detach myself. I don't want this in my life. You know, if I can help, and if someone asks me for help, obviously I will do it, and whatever I can. But to get myself involved in all these politics and ego games, etc., it's not necessary for me, and it's not something that I would like to do, to be honest. So if they have some ideas, if they need something that I can do, or I can help, or I can bring from whatever knowledge, whatever I can, I will do it with great pleasure and delight. But to get involved in it and to push myself, I don't think this is my type of contribution.
Well, you're currently in the Philippines. You've got plans to go back to Israel and live there with more of your life?
No. So my plan is not to go back to Israel. I'm very happy here. I was living before that for 25 years in London. I was very happy there as well. So no, I don't see myself living in Israel. I love the country very, very much. I visited. I was just there like a month ago together with my oldest son to visit the kibbutz, my sister Grace, my dad, and some other family in Israel. I love it very much when I go there, but to live there, I don't think it's something that I would do. But you can never say never in life.
Well, I've been speaking today with two people who are on the same page, at least as far as that's concerned, with Eitan Drori, who also has chosen this wonderful country of Australia to live in, and you've chosen Philippines, which I've never visited, but I believe is a wonderful place to visit. It's got a few issues currently with China breathing down its neck, and I hope that they don't have any impact upon your life in the Philippines. I have to thank you both for joining me today and having this conversation, which has been a delight for me to have you both on the show.
Thank you for having me, David. Thank you, Eitan, for your very excellent questions. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Al, very much for joining us this afternoon.
Just been speaking there with Ahal Bezarai and Eitan Drori. Now, the United Nations Special Rapporteur on the Promotion and Protection of Human Rights and Fundamental Freedoms While Countering Terrorism, quite a title, happens to be Professor Ben Saul, Chalice Chair of International Law, Sydney Law School, and elected Academic Fellow of the Sydney University Senate. I spoke with him a couple of days ago, and what was meant to be a 10-minute interview went for 40 minutes, and I'm grateful to Ben Saul for having given me that much of his time. That means I'm only able to play a part of our entire interview, but I'll be making the full interview with him available as a separate podcast, which you'll be able to find at Omni Studio and on the J-Air website. In what you'll hear today, we tangle over the consequences of the accidental killing of an Australian aid worker and examine Israel's handling of humanitarian aid for Gaza but I recommend listeners to check out the full podcast to listen to how our interview ended up.
Well, I thank you for joining me on the Israel Connection, Ben.
Good to be with you, David.
Now, in response to the accidental killing, widely considered to be an accidental killing of Zomi Frankel, the aid worker who was killed in Gaza just a week or so ago, the appointment of a special advisor by the Australian government, you believe is a wise, considered move. And you've pointed out that the Australian government has done this because it doesn't trust the integrity of the Israeli investigation. Do you want to perhaps elaborate on why you believe Israel should accede to such a request?
Look, I think the circumstances of the killings have obviously attracted global attention, including from the various countries whose nationals were killed. Obviously, lots of governments and countries are interested to get to the bottom of what happened. Israel's done the right thing, of course, in conducting a prompt investigation, which, of course, it's required to do under international humanitarian law, under the Geneva Conventions, when there's concern about violations of international law. I think the Australian government obviously believes that there are still potentially some unanswered questions there in the explanation given by the Israeli authorities. Israel itself has referred it to a criminal investigation by the military prosecutors in Israel. So for Israel, it's not the end of the story either. So I think if Israel does want to be transparent and demonstrate that it was a mistake, as it has said, then there's nothing to fear by having some kind of scrutiny or oversight by a close allied government like Australia.
Well, Australian National University International Law Professor Don Rothwell has said this appointment is unprecedented. Doesn't it open the door potentially to the interference of many countries in the internal affairs of other countries by going ahead with such a measure, which has really not been seen at all before?
You're right, it's unusual, although, of course, many countries do have military-to-military cooperation or law enforcement cooperation, including sometimes on joint investigations. To my mind, it's not an interference in Israel's internal affairs because it could only do anything with the cooperation of the Israeli authorities. So it's not like an Australian investigator can just show up in Israel and start investigating themselves. I mean, they've got to have the consent and cooperation of the Israelis. So it's for the Israelis to decide whether they want to do that. Secondly, I don't think it's an interference in internal affairs because under the Geneva Conventions, every country has an interest in the enforcement of international humanitarian law. So there's a provision, it's called Common Article 1 of the Geneva Conventions, which requires all countries not only to respect humanitarian law themselves, but to ensure respect by other countries for it. So it's well accepted under international humanitarian law that there's an international interest in the observance of humanitarian law. And if there are doubts about whether one country is respecting international humanitarian law, it's absolutely appropriate for other governments to take steps to be assured that it is being enforced in the way it should be.
Yeah, there are many other instances where countries like China let off the hook because it's deemed to be politically importune to really go ahead with such measures. In this case, no other nation who was affected, Canada, the United Kingdom, Poland, the United States, has announced any similar measures. The Biden administration says it's indicated that it's satisfied with what Israel has done. Isn't Australia really putting itself out on a limb, endangering its relationship with Israel by approaching it in this untrustworthy fashion?
Well, look, I think Israel has risked its relationship with Australia by not taking enforcement of humanitarian law seriously. I mean, the last 6 months, of course, it's inflicted a deliberate famine on the people of Gaza, which is the war crime of starvation. I mean, there have been many other allegations of serious crimes by Israeli forces over the last 6 months. So I think if all countries should do better to enforce international humanitarian law, not only against Israel. And you're absolutely right, David, that Of course, there's lots of double standards in international politics, where states treat some countries lightly and don't do enough to enforce international law generally against lots of countries. And we all know the reasons for that. Sometimes it's about trade or the economy or politics, other kinds of diplomatic relations. So as an international lawyer myself, someone interested in the impartial enforcement of international law everywhere, I absolutely encourage all countries to do more in enforcing international law everywhere. Every step we can take to improve that enforcement, including this suggestion of a special advisor, is positive from my standpoint. If Israel's got nothing to fear, it shouldn't worry about Australia taking a look at its investigation.
Seems to be really overblowing the situation. One compares other instances that have occurred, and this has been highlighted in the media. Like, we can look at the Kunduz hospital airstrike in 2015, which is on a scale far, far worse than this. We've seen also how Germany has, in its federal court, concluded in 2010 that a Taliban convoy that was targeted with 142 civilian deaths did not amount to a war crime, as there was no intention shown. So this seems to me to be really taking a very, very pointy attack for something which doesn't measure on a scale compared to these other incidents that were really not treated in the same way with so much attention.
Look, I think you have to look at every incident on its own merits. Of course, sometimes mistakes in targeting are made under international humanitarian law. And just for your listeners, I mean, the obligation under international law is to do everything feasible to verify what the thing is before you launch an attack on it. So to check that it's a military target, it's not civilian. Also to check that the attack would not cause excessive civilian casualties. Now, sometimes you do all the right things. You look for all the information you need. You double check. You get information from electronic sources or drone footage or informants on the ground, and mistakes can still happen. Now, in those circumstances, there is no violation of international humanitarian law if it's an honest mistake and you did all the things to check in advance. I think the appointment of the special advisor is because the government must have some doubt about whether the Israeli forces did do enough in checking what those targets were, given that Israel attacked three vehicles on the basis that it suspected there might be two militants in three vehicles, which, of course, as you know, could carry at least 15 people. So there could well have been carloads full of civilians, whether they're aid workers or just Palestinians. Doesn't matter. They're all still protected civilians. And so if you do launch an attack in those circumstances, it raises real doubt about what was the information you relied on to believe that they were Hamas fighters? What was the information you relied on to believe that the cars had no civilians in them, that you were also going to kill if you launched that strike? And I think the fact that we haven't enforced international humanitarian law well in other conflicts, and in that I'd include Afghanistan, I'd include the Western Air campaign against ISIS in Syria and Iraq some years ago as well, is also, to my mind, shocking. I mean, we should enforce that better. I think Australia's doing not so bad in that it's at least set up a serious office to investigate and prosecute potential war crimes by Australian special forces in Afghanistan. That's something the Americans haven't done, the British haven't done, when there have been pretty serious allegations about some of their conduct in those conflicts as well. So, look, there's a long way to go in the enforcement of international humanitarian law. And as I said, every little step we can take to improve it, including to give justice to the victims, because, of course, they're the ones we shouldn't lose sight of in all of this, is a positive thing.
Now, there have been about 200 aid workers that have been killed in Gaza, as you would know. Australia hasn't really made any particular statements or concerns about them, and only now people are highlighting the deaths of these other aid workers. Now, these aid workers would have been largely complicit with Hamas, and that's why they would have been targeted. So this seems to be a really not proper handling or measuring of the weight of these different circumstances. And why would we be looking at the deaths of aid workers and other people who are working in Gaza who are actually complicit with Hamas? Why should we have any special sympathy for people who are working with Hamas? Do you let them off the hook? Because I believe you don't believe that Hamas is even a terrorist organization.
So, look, there are a lot of assumptions in what you just said, David. Let me work through them. Firstly, foreign governments have a special interest under international law in protecting their own citizens when they are injured by a foreign state. That's just a rule of international law, which has always been there. So governments are allowed to make diplomatic representations to other governments they suspect of harming their citizens. Of course, if an Australian citizen is at risk, whether it's an Australian in Guantanamo Bay or Julian Assange, or you know, all of the cases we know where sometimes governments say things to other countries, of course they're going to do that. That's their job, and that's a right under international law, as Israel looks after its own citizens in other countries when they're put at risk as well. So I don't think there's anything unusual about that. Secondly, a point I would make is one I've already made publicly, which is I absolutely think it's in some ways really unfortunate that it takes the killing of foreign nationals for foreign governments to get interested in Israeli potential war crimes in Gaza. On the 200 aid workers you mentioned, I'm not sure the circumstances of all of those, because, of course, each incident is different. Some may have been deliberately targeted. I don't know. I haven't looked at those figures. Some might be just aid workers who are civilians killed in their homes along with their families, because that's also been how many people have died in Gaza. So it's a question of whether some were targeted or some were just incidental civilian casualties of other Israeli operations. Your assumption that they must be complicit with Hamas, I utterly reject. I think that's a smear on humanitarian actors in Gaza. You know, these are people who put their lives on the line in order to feed and clothe and shelter and give medicine to civilians in an utterly catastrophic humanitarian situation. So the last 6 months, and this is on Israel, David.
But UNRWA has been proven.
Let me finish. In the last 6 months, at present, there are 600,000 people on the verge of starvation. There are 1.1 million people who are facing chronic hunger, and the rest of the population is facing acute hunger. So these aid workers, yes, of course, they some of them, if they were working with the Hamas authorities, yes, they had an association with Hamas. It was the government. I mean, somebody had to run the place after Israel left. That's not to say you support Hamas. It's just the fact of how the place was being run. That doesn't make them terrorists. I mean, if you're working for the Hamas authority, feeding people, or you're a doctor in a Palestinian hospital in Gaza, that doesn't make you a dangerous Hamas terrorist. That makes you somebody who's doing your job in a civilian administration. Your assumption that I don't think Hamas is a terrorist organization, I've never said that. What people need to be very clear about is what I have said, which is that there is no definition of terrorist organization under international law. There are definitions under national law. So Israel says Hamas is a terrorist organization. Australia says Hamas is a terrorist organization. That's up to them. You know, they make the law. I don't make the law. I don't make international law. The Security Council has not listed Hamas as a terrorist organization. So and most countries in the world have not listed Hamas as a terrorist organization. So that's not me, David. That's countries, and that's international law, which has not agreed what terrorism is for all kinds of political reasons. My job, I've been appointed by the United Nations to monitor human rights when states counter terrorism. So if Israel calls Hamas a terrorist organization, my job is to ensure Israel respects human rights when countering terrorism. I've got no authority and no power myself to make up some kind of international law which says Hamas is a terrorist organization. So this kind of gotcha stuff which people play in the media, trying to force people to name Hamas as a terrorist organization, I think is really quite unhelpful. I've also said, and this is very clear, that Hamas has committed very serious war crimes on a systematic scale. War crimes are defined under international law. Terrorism is not. War crimes are international crimes under international law. So if you want to call Hamas the worst thing under international law, call them war criminals, because that's what they are. There is no category of terrorism. So I don't know why people are fixated on this labeling of an organization as terrorist or not, when actually it's not as bad as calling them war criminals, which is what I have always said since October 7.
But you have opposed the Australian government prescribing Hamas as a terrorist organization. And given what Hamas committed on October the 7th, it would be, I think, evident to anybody who has got any kind of common sense that Hamas has behaved like a terrorist organization in the act that they carried out. So wouldn't that have changed your mind and what you thought perhaps a couple of years ago?
Again, David, what you've just said is a total misrepresentation of the submission I made to a parliamentary inquiry, which was to say that if you do classify Hamas as a terrorist organization, because of the criminal offences under Australian law, which flow from that listing of a group as terrorist, it means that you suddenly criminalise all kinds of innocent civilian activity connected with the Hamas administration in Gaza. So if you're a rubbish collector for Hamas under that listing, that's the crime of association with a terrorist organisation. If you provide medical care or assistance in a hospital to civilians, you're not a fighter, you're not violent, you're not trying to hurt anybody, including Israelis. That makes you a terrorist under Australian law. Now, that's clearly unprincipled, inappropriate, excessive. It punishes ordinary civilians and the ordinary civilian population. And I would never say that that is appropriate for Australian law to do that. I never opposed, and if you read my submission, which you clearly have not done, if you read the submission, you'll see that I did not take any position about classifying Hamas as a terrorist organization in principle. The problem is that the sum of the criminal offences which flow from that designation are excessive. So my argument was simply that Australia should not criminalise ordinary civilian activity, and I think most sensible people would agree with that position.
Now, you've considered civilian objects to retain protected status even when used for military purposes. Now, we know Hamas has been using civilians as human shields in...
David, I have never said that. If you can send me where I've said that, I'd be very surprised.
Well, I think you said that on X and on March 28th.
Well, that's, again, that's a complete misrepresentation, David. I'm an international humanitarian lawyer. I have always said if something is used for a military purpose, it can be a military objective. But the second step under international humanitarian law, and these are rules which Israel itself has agreed to, is that you cannot attack a military objective if it would cause excessive civilian casualties. So even if it is a military objective, yes, sometimes you can't attack it because there's a second rule. And if you don't understand that that's how humanitarian law works, and again, you take this kind of cheap gotcha approach, then of course you're going to misrepresent what people say, and you'll misrepresent what international law says.
Isn't this a nonsense of international law that it works on this principle of proportionality, which can be interpreted in any old which way?
Look, I agree with you that unfortunately the proportionality rule is, of course, open to potential abuse and excessive interpretations which are not in the spirit of international humanitarian law. And I think we see that in Gaza. Israel is interpreting the proportionality rule clearly in a manner which is excessive, tolerating many more civilian casualties than other like-minded democracies would ordinarily tolerate. There was a story last week about Israel in the early phases of the war potentially allowing the killing of 15 to 20 civilians in order to kill one member of Hamas, and not a senior leader, just a regular Hamas fighter. You can kill their whole family and all their relatives. And Israel was doing that on multiple occasions in the opening stages of the war. So yes, some states do clearly abuse international humanitarian law. But what's the alternative, David? If you can come up with a better rule, the rule says you cannot cause excessive civilian casualties relative to the military advantage. So the point of the rule is to say if the military objective is really, really important, you could potentially allow a greater number of civilian casualties. If it's not particularly important, like a Hamas foot soldier at home with his family, not in the middle of a military operation where there's no particular urgency to target that person, absolutely not. You cannot murder 20 civilians in order to eliminate that one soldier. So it's on governments to do the right thing. Governments have made that rule. Israel was part of making that rule. Israel supports that rule, and it's for Israel to respect that rule.
You've accused Israel of not doing enough to facilitate the delivery of humanitarian aid to Palestinian civilians in Gaza. You said earlier when we spoke about Israel using starvation as a weapon of war. Now, Israel's task in Gaza is to eliminate Hamas and not to be primarily concerned about the needs of the civilian population. So Israel is facilitating other organisations coming into Gaza to do that job. That's its obligation, nothing more, nothing less. I think Israel, by organisations that are antipathetic to Israel, they're using this as a weapon to criticise Israel when Israel is doing everything within its means, given the fact that its primary concern there is to eliminate Hamas, and these concerns about humanitarian aid are only making it more difficult.
Look, once again, David, I disagree with some of the assumptions you make there. So when you fight a war, it is an obligation to ensure that you fight the war in a way which protects civilians as much as possible. That includes in the facilitation or direct delivery of humanitarian relief. So in terms of humanitarian relief, for the last 6 months, if Israel were doing enough, you would not have 2.3 million people facing acute food shortages. You would not have around 30 children already dying of malnutrition. In the north of Gaza at the moment, right now, there are about 30% of children are suffering from severe wasting. That means emaciation. The chief reason why civilians in Gaza have been starving is because of Israeli policy. Now, you're right that Israel itself doesn't necessarily have to deliver the food itself, but it has to get out of the way and allow others to do it. And it has not been doing that. The latest figures from the United Nations suggest that since 7 October, so in the last 6 months, only about one quarter of the total daily truckload of relief supplies over that period have got into Gaza, in a context where civilian infrastructure, food production facilities, etc., have been largely destroyed across Gaza. So the population can't fend for themselves. So they're more reliant than they were before October 7 on international relief. The number of or the amount of food relief getting in is a quarter of what it used to be when the Gaza Strip was functioning in an ordinary civilian way. Just to give you figures from the last few weeks, in North Gaza, the UN figures show that only 16% of the population was reached by food distribution. It's a bit better in the middle, so it's about 45% in the middle of Gaza, and in Rafah, in the south, it's about 30%. But that tells you that most of the population is still not getting the food it needs. And if they are reached, it's not reached at the level you need to prevent the kind of starvation, hunger, malnutrition that we're seeing across that area. Now, it's got a little bit better in the last few weeks because of US pressure. Unfortunately, Israel did not comply with the multiple orders of the International Court of Justice, which are legally binding under international law, to let more food aid in. It didn't respect the United Nations Security Council demanding a ceasefire so that humanitarian aid could get into the territory. And of course, it's been shutting down UNRWA, which is one of the largest humanitarian relief providers in the Gaza Strip, because of what it says are its security concerns. But of course, if you do that and you don't provide an alternative, then you starve people even more. Look, this was clearly announced by Israel at the start of the campaign when the defense minister said, we will not let humanitarian relief supplies into Gaza. And this has been a policy of Israel to starve people over the past 6 months.
You've been listening to Professor Ben Saul from the University of Sydney, who is the United Nations Special Rapporteur on the Promotion and Protection of Human Rights and Fundamental Freedoms while Countering Terrorism. Unfortunately, Ben Saul fails to acknowledge that much of his criticism of Israel regarding the situation in Gaza must be laid squarely at the feet of Hamas and its cronies, who are stealing a lot of the aid for their own nefarious purposes and firing on their own people as a tactic to bring blame onto Israel. And con the Western media and anti-Israel activists or operators like Ben Saul, who could be put into that category, these have been snared into the propaganda clutches of Hamas. I advise you to listen to the full podcast of my interview with Ben Saul, which got quite interesting towards the end. I haven't been able to play it on this show today because of time constraints. Please consider supporting what we do here at JAIR by becoming a member. Just go to the JAIR website to join. It costs only $50 per annum and will keep us broadcasting for your benefit 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Until next week, it's goodbye from the Israel Connection. יצא לי קצת לחשוב אבל התחיל לחוב אם גם את משתכרת כדי לשכוח אותי זוכרת איך עברו כמעט שנתיים שהיו שרתי לך אבל אותך זה לא יחזיר אליי די הבנתי שזה כבר נגמר ביי ביי סגרנו וזה לא עבר את עוד זורמת לי בתוך הדם אני שחררתי אותך אבל